Hello, and welcome to Northwestern Exposure, a weekly look at whole systems approaches to issues affecting individuals and communities in the industrial world. I'm Paul Nelson. Over 4 million Americans are estimated to be practitioners of a religion that predates Christianity. That would make it the fastest growing religion in America. We're talking Wicca, or the old religion, as Phyllis Kirod likes to call it. A Wiccan high priestess, Phyllis says the bias against modern witches has a very old historical precedent.
It's a stereotype, and in fact, it's a religious prejudice. Most people don't understand where it came from. It came from the persecutions, as you said in your opening, 200 years worth of persecutions that grew out of the Inquisition, actually, the success of the Inquisition. The accusations against witches had previously been made with tremendous success against the Jewish community in Europe. Exactly. The entire image, the big nose, the wart on the nose, the copulating with Satan, worshiping Satan, killing Christian babies, all that stuff, all of which is a great big lie, was what was used to persecute Jews.
Phyllis goes beyond setting the record straight in her new book, Witchcrafting, A Spiritual Guide to Making Magic. She ties in the fact that quantum physics is validating some of the notions of Wicca, like the belief that everything has energy. Wicca is about magic, but Phyllis says not parlor tricks.
Magic, to me, is not something, like we said it before, it's not something that you do to the universe with your mind or even with your heart and your body. It's something. It's a dance that you do with the universe. Magic, it's all the events that flow once you've gotten the blindfold off and you've made a connection to that indwelling divinity, and you've learned how to see it and connect to it in other people and in your pets and in your garden and in the sky and in all the marvelous aspects of nature that surround us and empower us.
A woman who has spoken to the United Nations alongside the Dalai Lama, Phyllis Kirod is a spiritual heavyweight and also just plain fun. A look at witchcrafting today on the program. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for tuning in. Our interview with Phyllis Kirod originally aired in November of 2001 and begins in just a moment. For details on program guests, underwriters, or upcoming programs, or to find out other stations and airtimes for this show, check out the website For It Plays in Peoria Productions at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org. You'll find show summaries, contact info, and details on the organization. inpeoria.org. Another village building project of It Plays in Peoria Productions. Once at inpeoria.org, you'll find a link to splab.org, the website for the Northwest Spoken Word Lab, co-sponsors of Sherman Alexie's visit to Green River Community College, November 14th at 7:30. Details at splab.org for poet, novelist, and movie maker Sherman Alexie. This program is made possible in part by a contribution from the City of Auburn, inviting small businesses and artists to consider relocating to a traditional small American town with commuter rail service to Seattle, low housing costs, and a strong sense of community. Details online at ci.auburn.wa.us. And by the Law Office of Peter G. Livengood, emphasizing the representation of people injured by defective products or through the negligence of others, as well as insurance coverage, real estate, business, and commercial litigation. Information at 206-282-5851 or online at liveingoodlaw.com. My daughter Rebecca is a typical 10-year-old American girl. She's into Nickelodeon, Britney Spears, and witches. That's right, witches. Not the stereotype ugly Halloween witch mixing Eye of Newt into a cauldron to put an evil spell on some man, but something resembling the spiritual practice of 4 million Americans who are reviving an ancient tradition that predates the three main biblical religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Perhaps it was the Harry Potter books that sparked Rebecca's interest. Perhaps the success of those books is just another sign of the end of the intense patriarchy of the last 2,000-plus years. Patriarchy exemplified by 200 years of witch hunts, by the laws that once considered women property akin to chattel, and all the modern-day manifestations that are coming to an end as women reclaim their birthright, a natural, powerful connection to the immanent divine. Phyllis Curott is a modern woman, an author, social and spiritual activist, practicing lawyer, and Wiccan high priestess. Her new book is Witchcrafting, A Spiritual Guide to Making Magic. Phyllis, a pleasure to have you on the show today.
A pleasure to be on the show today.
This is going to be good. I'm really looking forward to this. You know, as we did with the last witch we had on the show.
I mean, I'm not the first.
No.
I'm not your first witch.
Francesca beat you by about 4 days, okay. 5 days. You know what she did? She did an invocation to make sure that this interview happens for the best and highest possible purpose of all living things everywhere. Would you so honor us?
Oh, that's lovely. That's very lovely. Every moment that we have to communicate with somebody else is a moment of magic. It's an opportunity for us to see the sacred in each other and to find it in ourselves. So thanks to Rebecca, and thanks to you, and thanks to the people who are listening. I want to say thank you because it's an opportunity for me to do what I love best, which is to have that moment of connection. So that's my spell. That's my Thanksgiving, and that's my prayer.
Amen. May it be so. You know, if you could have told me 10 years ago that I'd be interviewing witches with my daughter listening, I'd have called the paramedics myself. But the world is changing, isn't it? Changing.
Yes,
your
it
own
is.
Experience, probably so.
Yeah. Well, if you'd asked me 20 years ago what I wanted to be when I grew up, it was not going to be a witch. It wasn't in my high school yearbook.
A witch and a lawyer.
Well, a lawyer's the dark side. You
know? I see. Yeah. I bet people still want to stay on your good side with those two.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Listen, if those fundamentalists really believed the truth about those crazy things that they think, I would stay completely out of my way if I believed that stuff.
What crazy things do they think?
Oh, it's, you know, the old party line that started 500 years ago and to some extent started 5,000 years ago, that witches are evil, that they worship Satan, that they have green faces and warts on their nose. What do you think, Rebecca? No green face, right? That they cavort with Satan, kiss him on the butt, and other acts that are we will not discuss.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And what else? That they kill Christian babies, fly around on brooms. I've been known to fly around on a broom or two in my day. But the rest of it is just, it's a stereotype. And in fact, it's a religious prejudice. Most people don't understand where it came from. It came from the persecutions, as you said in your opening, 200 years worth of persecutions that grew out of the Inquisition, actually, the success of the Inquisition. The accusations against witches had previously been made with tremendous success against the Jewish community in Europe. Exactly. The entire image, the big nose, the wart on the nose, the copulating with Satan, worshiping Satan, killing Christian babies, all that stuff, all of which is a great big lie, was what was used to persecute Jews, to torture them, to kill them, and to confiscate their property, and to disenfranchise them from the political and cultural life of Europe. It was a very successful campaign, and it was turned on sort of the remaining competition, as it were, which were the practitioners of the old religion of Europe, the indigenous shamanism of Europe and the Middle East. And it was a persecution of women, largely women. There were men and women who practiced the religion equally, but the persecution was focused primarily upon women. And it was really the women's Holocaust. They went from being people to being property that could be disposed of and killed by husbands and brothers. And they weren't allowed to receive an education, very much like what's happening to women in Afghanistan. You couldn't teach a woman to read or write. She couldn't own property. She couldn't inherit it. She couldn't run a business. They weren't allowed to practice medicine, which they had as herbalists and as midwives who birthed babies. And they couldn't practice their religion. They couldn't function as the shamans in the villages where they lived. And so the old religion was almost entirely wiped out.
Maybe it's a manifestation of that patriarchy and prejudice, but you know, when we think of shaman, we think of man. We think of maybe Native American man or African man. Obviously, women had that kind of connection, and it was the old religion. Why don't you give us a sense of the history of that?
Well, the fact is that Western civilization, we tend to think of Western civilization beginning with Greek culture, with Plato, you know, and the old boys network. But in fact, Western civilization was born in the lap of the goddess, or from the lap of the goddess. The earliest signs of the human attempt to express its vision of divinity were figures of female goddesses that date back 25,000 BC. 25,000 BC. And the very first religions actually worshipped goddesses. And they go back to 7,500 BC throughout the Fertile Crescent, what we think of as the Middle East. They were, by and large, peaceful cultures. They were agricultural. They worshipped a goddess. And there were women who served as priestesses. The fact is that much of the culture that we have inherited now was influenced by 10 to 12 critically important priestesses. They were called the Sibyls, and they had sacred sites, sacred centers, temples that were devoted to a particular goddess scattered all around the Middle East. Thebes, the most famous, of course, is the Oracle of Delphi. And she was the counselor of Athens, which was the most powerful city-state, and which is what we think of when we think of the birth of Western civilization. But no decision was made. No political, social, military, economic decision was made without a consultation with the priestess at Delphi first. And there was one, the Libyan Sibyl, who was devoted to the goddess Isis. The Cumaean Sibyl was the counselor of Rome, the establishment of Rome. So for quite thousands of years, the fact is that women played a critical role as priestesses, as wise women, and as counselors and informers of culture.
We're talking with Phyllis Curat. She's a Wiccan high priestess, and her new book is Witchcrafting, A Spiritual Guide to Making Magic. I'm Paul Nelson. Now, my daughter's 10, knowing that she has some interest in this. The Harry Potter books help. The culture, the change in culture that's happened has helped. When did you first know that you had witch-like tendencies?
Well, you are really getting a jump on the game. I wish I'd started when I was 10. It sort of started for me in my second year in law school, very unexpectedly, what I now understand is a shamanic break, which is essentially a kind of spontaneous opening of consciousness to a broader experience of reality, an experience of the world as alive, as divinely alive. And all kinds of crazy things happened. I started having dreams that came true, and a keen sensitivity to other people's thoughts and feelings. I could sort of read them very quickly, and then what I sensed they would suddenly say. And I just had this sense that I wasn't alone, you know, that there was a presence accompanying me. And I started exploring. It was New York, and it was the late 70s, and I had never taken drugs during the 60s because I was a political activist fighting against the war. It was either drugs or politics, and I picked politics. I had no frame of reference. Esalen was out here on the West Coast. It might as well have been, you know, in Australia for all the difference it meant to a New Yorker. I went to an Ivy League school, got my degree in philosophy, and I was at law school in New York. I mean, hardcore.
You went to Brown University.
I went to Brown University. Yeah. And but these experiences were phenomenal. And I think initially I was unnerved by them, but because they had this objective component, because I would have a dream and then it would come true, because I would sense that the phone was going to ring and then it would ring. And I would think it would be, you know, a long lost friend. And it was, you know, things that you couldn't predict. I realized there was more to reality than I had ever been raised to believe. You know, there was just more going on. And I started trying to figure out what it was. And being a rationalist, I started looking into physics. And I discovered quantum physics and the idea that everything's energy and everything's interconnected and that human beings have a capacity to affect reality at this very amazing level of energy that we mostly don't see, but which is there all the time. And events started to play out. That's what I talked about in Book of Shadows. And I was led to a coven of witches in New York. And I was the last place in the world I ever could have imagined myself. Not in a million years. Not in a million years. I was offered an invitation to study with them. And I said, thank you very much. Walked out the door. I never intended to go back. But the universe sent me a very powerful sign. And in the form of a Sibyl, the Libyan Sibyl, who I'd been dreaming about, she appeared. And I decided I better go check it out. And I didn't find a single green-faced hag, no warts, nothing, no Satan, none of that nonsense. There's no Satan in the old religion. I just found a group of fascinating women of all different ages and races and religious backgrounds. And they were seeking the goddess, and they were seeking the power that they had within themselves to create the lives that they wanted, lives that included gifts that we mostly neglect, but that are part of all of us.
Well, there's a couple of things in that answer that I want to follow up on. One is the notion of quantum physics, 20th century physics. And I say that very very distinctly, 20th century, because we are in the 21st. And this is old stuff. It's not new, but it hasn't seeped into the culture yet.
That's right.
And that is, even though this board right here, or this book, seems really solid, when you get down to the very smallest particles, there's a lot of space in it.
Yeah, it's energy and space.
Tell us, you know more about it than I do.
I have a layperson's understanding of quantum physics. I've always, it scared the heck out of me when I was in high school. I just wanted to run for the hills when I had to take physics classes. But as I got older, I started to get more and more fascinated. I mean, in very simple terms, quantum physics tells us that everything is energy. At its simplest level, within an atom is a particle, and within the particle is spin and space and energy. It's all energy. Your energy, your father's energy, my voice going out into the ether is energy. Everything's energy. It's a huge field of energy, organized as Rebecca and as me and as a microphone and as a book. But it's all energy, and it's all connected in that field. And most remarkably enough, that the human mind has a capacity to interact with the universe at that at that energy level to make things happen. And it's phenomenal. What kinds of things? Healing. Fascinating. There are all these studies being done now about the power of prayer. People who don't know that they're being prayed for have a higher recovery rate from terminal illnesses when they're prayed for. They don't know it. They have no idea they're being prayed for. They have a higher, statistically, significantly higher recovery rate than people who are not prayed for. It's amazing. Magic.
Thank you, Larry Dawsey, for pointing these things out.
Hey, you know?
Yeah.
Right. The problem is that, you know, witches have been so misunderstood that what we understand, what we perceive, and what we work with, it's easier for Larry Dawsey to say it and to be heard than for a witch to say it.
Yeah, someone who's a Vietnam vet and an MD and has credibility in the old ways.
That's right.
Who understands the new ways.
That's right.
And that's the essence of a shaman.
Yes.
That bridge between worlds.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think that, you know, part of my ability to speak to the mainstream and the credibility I have comes from the fact that I'm a lawyer. An Ivy League lawyer.
Who spoke before the UN.
Yeah, I was very active with the Beijing Conference on the Status of Women, and also the Parliament of the World's Religions, where a lot of very significant religious leaders showed up, including the Dalai Lama. We are out of the broom closet, little by little.
And that's something I had to point out. Did you write that, broom closet?
If somebody else wants to claim credit for having said it first, that's fine with me. I don't know where I got it from,
The notion of being closeted like a gay person, but in your case, broom closeted.
With all those dust bunnies, made me sneeze. I couldn't do it. I was allergic. I had to out as fast as I could. I got out in 1985, and I've been out ever since.
Well, a couple of things about the Bible and about traditional religion. First of all, you said in the answer to a previous question, there's no Satan in the old religions.
Right.
That was something of, well, the new religions, the ones that have been around for 2,000 years.
Belongs to them. He's theirs. He's their demon. They created him. He appears for the first time in the Old Testament. And each religion, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, has their own relationship and ascribes their own measure of importance to Satan, to the devil. But he belongs to the biblical religions. He's their personification of evil. He doesn't exist within the indigenous shamanism of Europe. We don't have a personification of evil, largely because it's a nature religion. It's an earth-based spirituality. And when you look to nature as the embodiment of the divine, which is what we do. In other words, that quantum energy, that energy field, that energy is sacred. It's divine. That's how we experience it using the practices that I describe in witchcrafting, shamanic practices that help us to get the blindfold off, see that quantum energy, to see that happening. And we see it in the world around us. It's like the world is the body. It's the outer form of that inner energy, and that energy is sacred. And when we work with that energy, we understand that we're connected, and we begin to see that all kinds of things are possible, that we're able to make magic. I lost track of your question.
Well, the notion of Satan.
Boy, did I wander far afield. He belongs strictly to them.
But that's good because, you talk about that he's theirs, mm-hmm. but let's look at the Bible as metaphor, for example. Okay, so maybe there's not a guy with horns who lives, you know, underground and it's real hot there. Maybe that's just a way of explaining it to people 2,000 years ago in a way they'll understand. But about the notion of evil.
Okay.
Right. Okay, so is there no evil on the planet?
No, there obviously is. I'm a New Yorker, you know. I was, you know, in New York when September 11th happened. And there's only one word to describe that. And, I mean, it was transparently evil. It was ferociously evil. The question is whether that evil is innate within each of us or whether it is a function of a malady that can be remedied. And that's... thank you for bringing me back. Because the point is that in a nature religion, when you look to nature as the expression of the divine and it is your spiritual teacher, evil doesn't exist in the natural world. If I'm out in a jungle and a lion jumps out and eats me for lunch, I'm lunch and it's a tragedy for me and my family, but it doesn't make the lion evil. You don't find evil existing in the natural world. It does, however, seem to exist in the human community. You know? And so the question is, where does it come from? I mean, the biblical faith will tell you that it is endemic. It's part of who we are. We were cast, you know, we defied God. We were thrown out of Eden. There's a tragic flaw within all of us.
And it's Eve's fault.
And it's, of course, it's Eve's fault. Running around without any clothes on, you know. And it was the snake's fault who was Satan, right? I'm sorry, I just don't buy it because nature is my teacher and I don't find it there, but I find it with human beings. So where do we, why? To me, it's the symptom of being separated from the sacred. It's a madness that has overtaken us for thousands of years because we've been living in a world that we believe has no divinity, that we live in a world that where God isn't present. God isn't present in the world. You go mad in the absence of the most important thing in the world, which is that sacred presence. You go crazy and you engage in acts that are evil out of that wound. I mean, that's a wound. That's the most important relationship that you can possibly experience has been denied to us. And in its place is this pain, is this terrible loss and this woundedness. And that's, I think, the origin of evil. That's where it comes from, that disconnect.
One other thing about the old religions is that they believe in miracles. Jesus walking on water, you know, turning water into wine, these kind of things. But you talk about miracles like that today, they want to lock you up.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when you look, one of the distinctions I think I made in witchcraft, the point is that other religions call it miracle. And the reason it's a miracle is that it comes from their one true God. There's no difference between, in a certain sense, what they consider to be a miracle and what we refer to as magic. They claim to have the only true path. I think the minute anybody says they have the one true path to the divine, they don't have any path at all.
Watch your wallet when that happens, right?
Hey, you know. The fact is, though, it's interesting to me that maybe there is a distinction between miracles and magic because a lot of miracles are indeed supernatural. They are contrary to the laws of nature. Walking on water runs contrary to the laws of gravity. Changing water into wine is physically impossible. Magic, however, is very real. It's not supernatural. It works with the natural laws that we live with. Those laws now including the laws of quantum physics, not just Newton's physics. Magic is real. It is as real as the sacred. The problem is that in the traditional religions, they've substituted faith for experience, which is have faith, but the faith comes from our experiences, not from a belief in something that we can't connect to.
It's an experiential thing.
It is. Yeah. It's exactly what it is.
The reaction to the events of September 11th seemed to reinforce that it is a man's world, and war, competition, and domination are the way of the world, have been here forever, and are here to stay. What gives you hope that this summation is wrong?
Oh, boy. The fact that I'm sitting here talking to you and that Rebecca is sitting next to me. The fact that, you know, this is my second book, and the first one is selling 3,000 copies a month. There's a movement afoot. There is species evolve when their survival depends on it. Our species is on the verge of extinction from overpopulation and destruction of the environment and depletion of natural resources. And from the kinds of self-destructive behavior that September 11th, is just...
Exemplifies.
Species evolve when they have to. We have to evolve. What's missing is right at hand. It's the values that we've suppressed. It's the values that are associated with the goddess, with the divine feminine, with compassion and nurturance and connection, with a rediscovery of the divine dwelling within ourselves, that God is not just, as it was described to me by a rabbi and a priest, some potter who created a pot and then left, but that the divine is always present in ourselves and in the world. And my hope comes from these practices because they really work. I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years now. I do it. I'm the ultimate skeptic. I'm a lawyer. I want proof. And these practices work. I get proof. I have these phenomenal experiences. I live a magical life. It keeps me going. It sustains me. And I live in a kind of gratitude. When September 11th happened, I woke up in the morning with a splitting headache. I don't get headaches. My head was just exploding in pain, and I took aspirin and it didn't do any good, and I got in the car, I didn't know what had happened. I was driving into New York City, and I got pulled over to the side by a phone call and a friend saying, "Where are you? Do you know what just happened?" I got turned back by the police when I tried to get into the city, and it was a few more days before I got in. I talked to several other of my women friends who also woke up that morning with these screaming headaches. The web had been ruptured in this hideous way. And we're all connected in that web, and we felt it. But we're also connected in joy. And I think the thing about Wicca that we've realized is that what happened on September 11th blew a hole in our hearts. And the hole never goes away when you suffer that kind of loss. But with the gifts that this spirituality offers us, we have a capacity to grow a bigger heart around the hole. And that gives me hope.
May it happen. Bookofshadows.net is the website.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay.
Book of witchcrafting.com.
Oh, very good. So there are a couple of different websites that we'll have links to on our website, inpeoria.org. Our guest, Phyllis Curat, is the author of Witchcrafting, A Spiritual Guide to Making Magic. We continue now with Phyllis Curat. She is a Wiccan high priestess, an author, a social and spiritual activist, practicing lawyer, and the author of Witchcrafting, A Spiritual Guide to Making Magic. Absolutely fascinated. Early in the book, you talk about how meditation is the first step to making magic. Why don't you tell us why that's so important?
Well, traditionally, magic has been defined as the art of changing consciousness at will. And it's been confined to that for many years, because I think in large part because a lot of our The influence on contemporary Wicca has come from ceremonial magical traditions, which were very patriarchal, based in the Bible, based in the Kabbalah, in the head. Meditation is more than just the mind, though. It is the first step, like changing consciousness at will, is the first step in making magic. It's just the first step. One of the primary reasons it's important is that a mind that's constantly babbling, it's talking all the time or worrying all the time, can't see what's right in front of it, can't see the sacred. It's just too much noise. There's static on the line. And so it misses the most important thing. You know, you can't hear the conversation because there's all this rattle going on. So you have to learn to quiet the mind. And the minute you start to quiet the mind, that inner voice begins to sing. And you also are able to apprehend the singing all around you. You're able to start to see the sacred. So that's the first step.
One, and the universe has ways of sometimes breaking through that chatter, and if we're paying attention, like maybe to someone's conversation going by, and I've never seen this word before. Is it Cledon?
Yeah.
I never saw that word before. I looked in my big dictionary. I looked at dictionary.com.
Yeah.
Finally did a web search for it, and your name came up with it.
Is that true?
Yes, it's a true story.
I'll be darned.
With Google. But words, and you know, in the poetry biz, we'd say it's a found poem. We'd work that into a poem as something found. They can have a divine message. Maybe you can tell us about that and about the case involving John Lennon you described in the book.
Oh, right. It's Cledon is a very ancient. The Greeks really were very aware of it. And it generally, it's a message from the divine. It's a magical message from the divine that comes through the voice in the crowd, usually a child, I think, because they're so generally innocent and open, sensitive, very sensitive. And so, you know, able to hear things that the rest of us don't hear because we're worrying too much. One of the stories in Witchcrafting is about a Cledon with John Lennon. After he was shot, there were lots of us in New York who went to Central Park right near the Dakota to gather, and people were lighting candles and they were singing, and they were they were singing a lot of John Lennon songs, and at one point this guy came over and was very angry, and said, "Do you have it there?
I fought the war for your sort."
Right, and was furious, and they responded
with the line from John Lennon from the A Hard Day's Night, the movie, and John Lennon said, "Bet you're sorry you won,"
right.
And it was in unison.
Yeah.
And in the book, you say how this was John's way of cheering these people up who were in tremendous, tremendous pain from having him be assassinated. As my father said, shows you the disconnect between his generation and mine.
Yeah.
So they shot a beetle, big deal.
Exactly.
That was his reaction.
Exactly. So the divine is always present, and it's constantly sending us messages. Personally, that's what I think a witch is. A witch is somebody who's paying attention.
That's very good, because Allen Ginsberg said poets are people who notice what they notice.
Yeah,
right? So there's some similarities there.
Absolutely. Well, the creative impulse, whether it's a poet or an artist or a musician, one of the greatest magics is music. And the creative impulse is the life force. That's sacred. That's holy. I mean, these days, the only shamans that we have left, aside from, you know, the witches that are making a resurgence, are the artists, the writers, the poets, the artists, the musicians.
Not just a resurgence of witches, but you say over 4 million Americans consider themselves Wiccans, which would make this the country's fastest growing religion. Where do these figures come from?
A number of places. One of the primary sources was statistical study that was done in the late 80s and early 90s out of the University of California. And a study had been done for about 15 years of Wicca and goddess spirituality and its growth. And at that point, there were the numbers were about 100 to 125,000 based on organizations, conferences, publications, mailing lists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever they used to try to cull numbers. And what they found was, in examining over that roughly 15-year period, they found that the numbers were doubling every 18 months. Every year and a half, there was a doubling in size. So if you extrapolate from that, you would come to a figure somewhere between 3 and 5 million, about 4 million. There are other sources that are really fascinating, though. one of them is, I think it's the marketing director for Barnes & Noble, who puts the numbers based on book sales at about 10 million, which I think is probably on the high end because witches read so many books because that's really, there aren't enough teachers, so people are learning from books. But there are a number of sources. And I think tolerance.org, is that it? Or religioustolerance.org has a nice article on the statistics involving Wicca. It's obviously very difficult because a lot of people are still in the broom closet, so it's hard to get a fixed number. But that seems to make sense. I mean, everywhere I turn, there's Rebecca. There are witches everywhere.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many people are interested in this?
Oh, there are a number of reasons. Certainly, the rapid growth, I think, had a lot to do with women. The critique that they ran of culture was very naturally extended to religion. And the patriarchal religions have been downright hostile, from the story of Eve through the restriction of priests and mullahs and rabbis to men, the demeaning of women. Religion has been used to oppress women, not to empower them. And women went looking for a spiritual home. And they found it in the old religions of the goddess. And they have been a tremendous influence on the creation of Wicca as a modern religion. And the goddess is a mirror that's really empowering for women. Young women have come to it because also it's empowering. You know, that women are very disenfranchised in this culture. And it's a source of power and a source of strength and encouragement. The other reason is it's a practice and it works. You don't have to be a woman. You can be a man. These are techniques. They're accessible. Anyone can do them. And they really connect you to the divine in yourself and in the world, and you really do start to live a very magical life.
Pandora's box has been opened, hasn't it?
I hope so.
Well, you know, when my daughter opens a book like yours, she's very interested in sections on spell casting. I think she asked me, can she make things float? Or I forget exactly what it was, but it was something like that. And it seems to me that not just 10-year-olds, but the average person, that might be one of the first things they want to look into. And yet, spell casting is not, you say, not about immediate gratification. And when some spells don't work, we may want to be thankful for that.
That's right. A lot of the literature, one reason that I wrote Witchcrafting was that I was really frustrated with so much of the literature that was out there. And it was very spell-oriented. And, you know, when people think of witchcraft, they think of magic, they think of spells. And the approach has been very mechanical. You know, what's a spell? You know, it's the secret formula. It's like the special way to make the machine operate, that the universe is a machine. And if you just have the right herbs and the right oil and the right potion and the right words, and you pull the lever, you know, the boyfriend will come down the chute. And it doesn't work that way because the universe is not a machine. The more you use these practices, the more you realize the universe is alive. It's conscious, it's interactive, it's alive. So a spell is not something you do to manipulate a machine to make it give you something that you want. It's a very dynamic, co-creative, religious practice that you... Magic is something you do with the universe, not something you do to the universe. And a spell is something that you create with the universe. And its purpose is, it's very much like a prayer. The difference is that people pray when they feel helpless, and they usually pray to a male god. When you work a spell or cast a spell, you're invoking the aid of a divinity that's greater than yourself. But it's not just a god, it can be also a goddess. But most importantly, you're going to the well of your own power, your own gifts, and your bringing it up and giving it shape and sending it out into the world. You're creating your destiny, and you never use a spell to control anybody but yourself. Spells are not supernatural. They work with the natural rhythms of your body and of the earth and the moon and the sun. You harness those energies. There's nothing supernatural about it. Certainly nothing demonic.
Yeah. Probably a good time to talk about your definition of magic and the definition of Aleister Crowley, his definition of magic. Maybe why don't you talk about those two things?
Yeah, well, the definition that the movement has sort of worked with for a very long time, to me, is just a starting place. And that's this idea of magic as the art of changing consciousness at will, Crowley, and then changing events in conformity with will. Dion Fortune and Starhawk also sort of popularized this idea. It's a great place to start, like meditation. It's a great place to start. But if we confine magic to the head, we're missing the whole point, because it's an earth religion. It's about the heart, and it's about your body, and it's about the earth, and it's about nature. It's not just about imagining things. It's not about, you know, sitting in your living room and visualizing things. It's about life. It's about being alive. It's about being fully present in the world. Magic, to me, is not something, like we said it before, it's not something that you do to the universe with your mind or even with your heart and your body. It's something. It's a dance that you do with the universe. Magic, it's all the events that flow once you've gotten the blindfold off and you've made a connection to that indwelling divinity and you've learned how to see it and connect to it in other people and in your pets and in your garden and in the sky and in all the marvelous aspects of nature that surround us and empower us.
Magic is what happens when you have encountered the divine.
Precisely.
That's how you say it in the book.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of magic, there's a section in the book called Real Magic early in the book, and I think it'd be a great place to do a little reading from it, maybe starting with page 37, the last paragraph on that page, starting with In Fact, and then going to page 38, the words, Had Experienced It Too.
And he hands this to me without my glasses.
Well, I will
make magic, and I will instantaneously be able to read.
Excellent.
It.
Well, let me just restate that we're talking with Phyllis Kurot. She's the author of Witchcrafting, A Spiritual Guide to Making Magic.
Yeah. In fact, magic is as real as the cold, wet nose on my dog, Webster. And he's experienced it also. It was the middle of summer, and my soon-to-be ex-husband, Bruce, and I had just adopted our Cairn Terrier. That afternoon, a terrible phone call came to tell Bruce that his father had died. I was sitting in the living room on the living room floor with Webster as Bruce walked into the room to tell me his sad news. And as I was looking at him, the air all around his upper body began to shimmer the way the horizon does during an intensely hot summer's day. And the space around him seemed to glow. And just as I noticed this, Webster began to growl. The hair on the back of his neck literally stood up on end, and he took several steps towards Bruce. He stood staring at him, Bruce later told me, at a point just over Bruce's right shoulder. I can feel my father, Bruce said, a stunned look on his face. He's here. Although he was feeling shocked, he began to talk to his father, telling him he could feel his presence. He expressed his love and then mentally asked what his father wanted him to do about his mother, who was now alone and was not well. He heard his father respond that he should take good care of her, that she would be with him very soon, and she died exactly 1 month later. And then Bruce told me later he began to feel uncomfortable, wondering if what he was experiencing was real, and so he told his father that perhaps he should go visit his brother, who was grieving and could probably be comforted by his father's presence. And in the instant that Bruce communicated that, he felt his father depart. And at that very moment, I saw the radiance disappear. And Webster finally sat down, and he relaxed. And then Bruce told us that his father had left. Any doubt I might have had about the experiences disappeared when I realized that this little creature, Webster, had experienced it also.
Yeah, animals are really tapped into that, and yet one of the symptoms, I think, of the patriarchy is the way we treat animals in this culture. You know, putting hogs in grates on top of each other, on top of each other, on top of each other, and the very machine-like way in which we treat food in this country, whether it be hogs or cattle or what have you, some of the practices that go on. Environmental degradation might be seen as a symptom of the patriarchy of the last 2,000 years. You're agreeing with this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact is the biblical cosmology says that God placed man upon the earth and gave him dominion over all the creatures of the earth. So we've essentially lived for thousands of years with this idea that it's a warehouse. We can take whatever we want from it and then treat it like a garbage dump and just sort of throw the stuff away. One of the most powerful experiences that I had at the very beginning when all of this stuff was just starting to happen, and I didn't have a name for it at the time. I was a lawyer. I was in Louisville, Kentucky. I was there on an organizing trip. I was fighting organized crime and trade unions. And when the day's meetings were all over, you know, I piled in the car with a bunch of these trade union guys, and they took me to this country and western bar, and we're driving along. I knew nothing about Louisville, Kentucky. We're driving along, and there's this huge wall on the right side while we're driving, and it was like all of a sudden we drove into this cloud. It's the only way I can explain it, and it was like this terrible pain and sadness and sense of helplessness came over me, and I sat in the back seat and I was crying. It was such an overwhelming emotion that just came out of nowhere. And I couldn't let these big tough union guys see I was crying. You know, they wouldn't take me seriously. As I wiped my face, and one of the guys opened the door after the car was parked, and I said, "Where are we?" He said, "It's the stockyard and the slaughterhouses." And I realized that what I was feeling was the consciousness of all those animals that were being killed on the other side of that wall. And that I became a vegetarian after that. I do eat meat now, but I don't eat a lot of it. I very rarely eat red meat. Yeah.
And eat free range meat, no hormones. Yeah. And the other thing I think is the reverence in way in you know, I mean, the animals understand that metaphor you used earlier. You go in the woods, you get eaten by a lion. It's not evil. It's lunch.
It's the food chain.
And they understand the food chain, but the way in which we treat it, you know, in a very mechanistic way, is not right.
That's right. I mean, there's absolutely no the Native Americans. Many of the tribes, the wonderful story is that when an animal was hunted at the moment of its death, that the hunter would go to the animal and draw its last breath into his and immediately begin to do prayers. And in fact, before the hunt, generally, the shamanic approach is to do a ritual to call the spirit of the animal, to ask it to give itself to you. And as soon as it dies, to give thanks and to make an offering for it, and never to take more than was needed, ever.
Well, that's just another symptom of our disconnection to the divine and certainly to the divine feminine. Circles have a certain power, too. You talk about that in the book, Casting a Circle. We have a writer's circle here, and magic happens in that. When I get into the schools and lecture on poetry, I ask the kids to get into a circle. For me, it's a way of showing that it's not me passing this wisdom down, that there's no hierarchy there, that I'm learning from them as well, which I'm probably learning more. but there's something magic about circles. Why is that?
Well, you just said it. I mean, for one thing, everybody in a circle is equal. I mean, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years. So yes, somebody who's only done it for 5 minutes, there's a difference in our experience. But a priest or a priestess is a teacher. The job is not to intervene or intercede or even interpret. It's to facilitate. It's to teach the person what you've learned so that they can use it for their own journey. And sitting in a circle is an expression of that essential equality. Also, energy moves in spirals, which in essence is a form of circle. That's the natural movement of all energy through the universe. It's circular. It's spiral. It's circular. So the minute you're in a circle, you're sitting and you're working energy, because that's one of the things that we do in circle, is we raise energy and we work with energy, divine energy, and we use it to transform ourselves and to create our lives and to make magic. And so that energy is moving in exactly the way energy moves. That's why we cook in round pots, because the heat is equally distributed throughout the entire contents of the pot.
And if we could see waves, we would see them as spirals going through.
That's exactly right. It's also a symbol of the goddess, and it's an expression of the infinity, the essential infinity of the spiritual aspect of the world.
Well, I'm not going to give her the last question, but if my daughter can pull down this microphone real quick and ask one short question, since you've been very good, Rebecca Rose Nelson here, my 10-year-old daughter, one question to ask of Phyllis, what would it be? I'm putting you on the spot, I know, but the first thing that comes to your head.
Well, when do you start, I mean, like with me, I'm very interested in this, but when would I start? Like, you know, like how you started to sense these things with the telephone calls and the cloud of the slaughterhouse. And
I think maybe you've already started. See, I think that those capacities are part of all of us. And ancient cultures, it was more accepted because our survival depended on those talents, those skills. Mothers have them. I mean, that was one of the things that I recognized right away. I always knew when my mother was calling me or when she needed me, I could hear her. And I bet, my guess is that you probably have that kind of very special relationship with your father and probably with your mother. Paying attention to that, and that's what a witch is. You just start to pay attention. Do you have a pet?
I have like
four.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Well, pick one. Animals communicate all the time, and that's another way of developing your skills by talking to your animal, treating it as an equal, and asking it to show you what it needs and to communicate with you.
Like through the mind or something.
Yeah, yeah. When my dog needs certain things, he sends me pictures, and I can see them very clearly. And he's very sensitive to my moods. So my guess is that there's probably one of those four pets that you probably have a very special relationship with. So you cultivate that. And you told me yourself you had that very remarkable dream that you had. When you have a dream like that, write it down. It's like it's like a muscle, and the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And the whole reason that you have that, it's not a parlor trick. What it is an expression of the fact that we're all connected, and that everything is interconnected, and that we all need each other, and that's what life is all about.
Well, make sure you get a copy of the book, Rebecca. And last question, we're almost out of time, and it's a horrible thing to do to give you this kind of question with very little time, but you know, you can pull
some magic up.
Your book was scheduled for release September 11th, 2001. What do you see irony in that, or what do you see in that?
Yeah, tragic irony. I was confounded, and then a very dear friend of mine said, well, the universe always seeks to establish balance. And so, in a sense, the book being released on that horrific day was a very small, a really small contribution to restoring the balance, to restoring life in the face of death.
I think you're being modest. You know what? I asked this of the last witch that was on the show, Francesca, and I don't think I communicated it well, but I think that, you know, I have friends who are working in the environmental movement, and they say, we've done damage that can't be repaired for thousands of years, and I disagree. I think if we can cultivate the kind of magic that you've cultivated and work together millions of people, that we can do things that we can't even possibly imagine at this time to restore the earth, the balance, and maybe to create new species or bring old ones back. I believe that.
I think you're right. To heal the wound at the heart of our culture. And that's what this path is about. It's a path of the heart. And it's a path that helps us to grow a bigger heart. You asked me to start with that magic, you know, that blessing. And the blessing was the magic that comes when we communicate and when we're in the presence of each other and the best of each other. And that's how we begin to do it. That was the point of the book, was to show people how easy it is and how incredibly rewarding it is. It's a different way to live, and it's the only way that we're going to live.
It's already impacted my life, and I wish you much success. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you, Rebecca.
Witchcrafting.com, the website. We'll have more information. In fact, we'll have links on our website at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org. Our interview with Phyllis Curat originally aired in November of 2001, and we play it again to wish you Happy Halloween from everybody at It Plays in Peoria Productions. For details on program guests, underwriters, or upcoming programs, or to find out other stations and airtimes for this show, check out the website for It Plays in Peoria Productions at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org. You'll find show summaries, contact info, and details on the organization. inpeoria.org. Another village building project of It Plays in Peoria Productions. Also at inpeoria.org, you'll find a link to the website for the Northwest Spoken Word Lab, splab.org, S-P-L-A-B. Click on that website and find out about Sherman Alexie's visit to Green River Community College on November 14th at 7:30. Sherman Alexie, poet, playwright, and movie maker. November 14th at Green River Community College. Details at splab.org. This program is made possible in part by a contribution from the City of Auburn, inviting small businesses and artists to consider relocating to a traditional small American town with commuter rail service to Seattle, low housing costs, and a strong sense of community. Details online at ci.auburn.wa.us. And by the Law Office of Peter G. Livengood, emphasizing the representation of people injured by defective products or through the negligence of others, as well as insurance coverage, real estate, business, and commercial litigation. Information at 206-282-5851 or online at liveingoodlaw.com. Well, that's our program. Details on guests or underwriters online at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org. Underwriters help keep this show on the air along with your tax-deductible contribution. please consider making a donation or buying a CD copy of today's show for $15 postpaid. Send a check with the show's subject matter and date to It Plays in Peoria Productions, 14 South Division, Auburn, Washington, USA 98001, or call us toll-free 888-735-6328 or at 253-735-6328. Website hosting from Speakeasy, providing nationwide dial-up and high-speed internet DSL connections to homes, businesses, and nonprofits. And the website host for Pacific Northwest Ballet and Seattle Opera, speakeasy.net. Opinions expressed on this show are those of the guests and don't represent this network, station, or program underwriters. The show is produced by It Plays in Peoria Productions, a nonprofit 501c3 organism reinventing audio arts to build community in the consciousness age. I'm Paul Nelson. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, please remember the words of Diane DePrima. The only war that matters is the war against the imagination.